My castaway this week is a singer. Physically, he's a big man, but in contrast, his voice is unusually high. He's a leading member of that increasingly important band of musical specialists, the countertenors. After Oxford, where he won a scholarship, he auditioned for Benjamin Britten, who immediately offered him the part of Oberon in his opera A Midsummer Night's Dream. Since then, he's hardly been out of work, establishing himself as this country's most distinguished countertenor and overseeing a renaissance in Baroque music. He himself remains modest about these achievements. My greatest claims to fame, he said, are that I knew Benjamin Britten and Peter Piers and that I once had lunch with Maria Callas. He is James Bowman. Did you really have lunch with Maria Callas?
I certainly did, in a hotel in Turin, yes. I remember it very clearly.
Was it an impressive occasion?
It was rather sad, anyway. She was sitting there on her own having lunch, and I was with Raymond Lebard at the time, and Sesto Bruscantini, an Italian baritone, and they knew her, of course, and they said, come and join us for lunch. And she was sitting there rather sadly with her dark glasses on. It was like something out of Separate Tables.
Well, now, tell me about this voice, because you have, a critic has written, the physical stature of a rugby forward.
Well, I used to play rugby, yes.
Oh, did you?
Very badly at school, yes.
But it is therefore surprising when this falsetto voice emerges from such a frame. How surprised were you that that was where you found your voice, as it were?
I wasn't surprised at all, but I know a lot of other people are. I was a boy soprano, and as far as I was concerned, that's what I wanted to sing, and I really didn't give a damn what anybody else thought.
But then can you make... Is it contrived?
Oh, yes, entirely. It's an artificial voice. There's such an awful lot of confusion about this, and we're nothing to do with castrati, we're nothing to do with all these curious freaks that exist in the vocal world. No, it's a contrived falsetto voice. It's highly developed and turned into a voice in its own right.
Isn't it a technique that is used also in pop music these days? I mean,
oh,
you do
much,
hear
yeah.
that.
Yeah, oh yes, falsetto is quite commonly heard. I mean, the obvious example is Jimmy Somerville. The Beatles have used it, the Beach Boys have used it. I mean, it's certainly not an alien vocal technique to the world of popular music.
I mean, I suppose Good Vibrations is the most obvious example,
yes.
isn't it? Beach Boys.
I think so, yes. I mean, that's the one that springs to mind.
But you would find that, in comparison with what you do, somewhat crude, shall we say?
Well, it's a terrible thing to say, isn't it? It's they use it in a more unbuttoned way, shall we say.
So what's the technique? What do you do?
You're actually singing through a very small orifice. When your chords vibrate, it's like they vibrate in a normal way of the membranes vibrating together. But when you sing falsetto, you tighten the muscles and sing through a much smaller orifice. That's the way of putting it without sounding too basic. The nearest analogy is the harmonics on a violin.
So instead of the whole vocal cord vibrating...
Exactly. You're using a small part of it.
Yes.
Exactly.
But why did you choose to do it?
Because I liked the repertoire and I liked the voice, and my particular upbringing, my school where I was at, was extremely interested in that sort of music. I mean, I had a very precocious Baroque background, and therefore to me it was no surprise to sing this particular repertoire.
Right. More of that in a moment, but let's get you to this desert island. Tell me about your music. What's the first disc you'll play there?
Well, a composer who I've loved all my life, really, since I was a small boy, was Benjamin Britten, who I've had a great deal of association with latterly in my career. I've always loved his music, and I've sung his opera Midsummer Night's Dream more times than I care to remember. But I'm very fond of his opera Billy Budd. I think it's a wonderfully atmospheric piece. I mean, Britten is a genius at conjuring up an atmosphere, as you'll hear in this extract. And this particular piece is a great favourite of mine, and Benjamin Britten and Peter Piers were good personal friends of mine. I wasn't a close friend, but they were both very kind to me when I was starting my career.
Thank you.
the opening of Benjamin Britten's Billy Budd with Peter Pears and the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Benjamin Britten. Tell me about how you first met him then.
Well, it was one of these marvellous things, you know, by chance. I just heard that auditions were taking place at Covent Garden for A Midsummer Night's Dream, and I was at this time a prep schoolmaster in Oxford, having finished my degree. And, you know, so many things happen by accident. You just happen to be the right person around at the right time. And I turned up at Covent Garden and auditioned for Midsummer Night's Dream.
This was mid-60s.
This was 66, yes, that's right. It was in the Crush Bar, that place where you go and get knocked over in the interval and you try and buy a glass of tepid white wine. Anyway, if you look under the stairs, there's a very beer-stained, battered little piano covered by a canvas cover. And this was wheeled out. They were having auditions, and Britten and Sir David Webster and various other people were sitting at the end where the doors are, where you come up, and we all had to sing at the far end. And luckily, I'd taken the trouble to learn a large chunk of the piece, so I didn't feel too much like a fish out of water.
Doesn't everybody do that?
Well, it was very strange. People turned up and sang very inappropriate repertoire. I mean, I think if you're auditioning for a particular piece, you sing that piece. Mm. I mean, if you're going to audition for Phantom of the Opera, you're not going to bring Don Giovanni along, are you? Or whatever. So anyway, I did this, and I think they were all a bit tired, because I came along at 3:45 in the afternoon, and they'd started at 10:30 that morning, and I think they probably had a bit too much to drink for lunch, and so they were all half asleep. Anyway, I started to sing, and they all woke up, started passing notes around, which is very nice. And after I'd done my bit, Britten came up to me and he said, have you ever appeared on stage? And I said, no, never. And he said, oh, we'll soon change that, which I thought was rather a good omen.
So you were discovered?
Well, I suppose I was, really, yes.
It's a classic lucky break.
It was. You're absolutely right. It was one of those things. I remember thinking, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it.
And he then asked you to go on stage, I think, for the opening of the Queen Elizabeth Hall.
That's right. I got a surprise invitation to take part in the first concert when the QEH was opened.
And that was because Alfred Deller had
That's
got
right.
Her.
He had been approached, but he wasn't free.
Mm. He was really the only countertenor around then.
Well, he was in those days. He was the big name, and the role in Midsummer Night's Dream had been written for him. He'd done it.
So, in that sense, the fact that Britten found you at that moment when Deller would have been, in his mid-50s, it was...
Yes, I mean, I was quite a useful acquisition at the time.
Yes, and you were almost bound to become the leading countertenor.
Well, I was quite lucky because there wasn't much competition.
Well, quite.
You've got to be honest about these things. If there's 50 sopranos and only one or two countertenors, I mean, you're obviously in with a chance, aren't you?
Absolutely. Let's have record number two. Tell me about that.
Well, this is a countertenor, a very esteemed colleague of mine, Michael Chance, singing one of my favourite composers, which is George Frederick Handel, from an opera I'm very fond of, Tamerlano, and he's singing the aria Cerco Invano di Placare with John Elliott Gardner and the English Baroque soloists.
Michael Chance singing the aria Cerco Invano di Placare from Handel's Tamerlano with the English Baroque soloists conducted by John Elliott Gardner. Michael Chance, the torchbearer for the next generation, really. He's in his 30s, isn't he?
Yes, Michael's in his late 30s. Yes.
But there's far more competition around these days.
There is. I mean, there were a mere handful when I started, but now there must be a lot of very high-quality countertenors around. I mean, 20, 25 singing soloists. Mm. I mean, a lot who sing in choruses as well, but singing, shall we say, worldwide. Other countries have now taken it up as well.
It remains, although less so, it remains a curious voice, nevertheless.
It does indeed.
That voice sounded to me like a female contralto.
Yes, that's interesting you say that, because to me I would know immediately it's a man, but being, as it were, on the other side of the fence, perhaps it's easier. But it doesn't sound effeminate. It might sound like a feminine voice, but it's not effeminate. It's an intrinsically masculine sound.
Is it? Because it was...
You don't sound convinced.
Well, I didn't think Alfred Dellis was.
Alfred was a very disembodied, wonderfully, almost a spiritual sound. It was another worldly sound. Michael makes a much more worldly sound, a creature of this planet, whereas I think Alfred made a sound as if he came from another world altogether.
But one of your critics, I think, another famous countertenor, Jochen Kowalski, has said that you sound disembodied.
Well, yes, he does. Jochen, of course, has a very vibrant, full-blooded, and his voice can sound quite effeminate. I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean it purely as a characteristic. It can sound like much more like a woman.
Mm.
My admirers and my detractors, I think, are all agreed that I probably sound like a man. I don't sound as if I was imitating a woman. But it's a very moot point, and if you sing in a high register, people are always going to associate it with... a feminine characteristic. This is inevitable.
So let me ask you then the obvious question. Back at school in the 50s, when you were 17, 18, your voice had broken, you cultivated this particular form of singing. Did you get a lot of stick from other boys?
Not really, because if you go to an all-male boarding school, boys have to play girls' parts in school plays. Boys have to sing everything in the choir. It's you have a go at singing that, and you're just told to do it. And the boys...
Yes, but it's different when you actually choose, isn't it?
Yes, but you see, the school I went to was associated with Ely Cathedral, where it was steeped in this English choral tradition.
Mm.
I mean, I quite agree. Some boys used to snigger a bit and say, but I used to say to them, I bet I'll make more money than you.
Probably right. When did you first hear a woman sing, then?
I remember hearing a performance of Messiah when I was about 17 or 18, and a female soprano came and sang the soprano solos, and I must say, I was absolutely amazed. I mean, I thought it was lovely, but I thought, oh, that's interesting. Yes.
Right, record number 3.
This is a very wonderful piece, which I love, and it's totally out of keeping with my normal repertoire. It's Hubert Parry, whose music, of course, I knew as a boy. We used to sing his anthems in the cathedral. But it's his Best Pair of Sirens, known rather irreligiously in the business as Best Pair of Nylons. But it's so quintessentially English that I've always loved it. And I love the text by Milton as well.
Hubert Parry's Blessed Pair of Sirens, sung by the choir of Winchester Cathedral with the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, conducted by David Hill. So if music, James Bowman, had been your life until you were 18, how come you got a history scholarship to Oxford?
Well, I'm not very academically minded. The thought of reading maths, the thought of reading greats, any of those subjects absolutely horrified me. So history was a fairly soft option.
And you studied under Hugh Trevor Roper?
Well... No, I went to his lectures, but I wasn't very good, and I'm afraid I didn't do a lot of work, and I got a fairly hopeless degree.
You got a fourth?
Yes, now. I got a fourth. That doesn't exist anymore.
What is a fourth? Is it a pass?
No, it's an honours degree.
You got a BA.
I was vivid, I think, from a fail up to a fourth, and I got the rabbit fur, and when I took my MA, the Vice-Chancellor, who I knew quite well, laughed out loud.
And you told, is this right, you told Trevor Roper that you'd never read a book?
Well, no. Hugh Trevor Roper actually said to me in exasperation at my viva when I was making a bit of a pig's ear, in desperation, he said, have you actually read any books at all in the last 3 years? And I bit my tongue and was almost about to say not many, but I thought it was not a good idea to be facetious, so I can't remember, I made some floundering remark. I mean, it's the most terrifying experience in Oxford Fifer, especially if you know you're teetering on the brink of oblivion.
Of a fail, yes.
And you have to dress up in this terrible white tie and thing, and go to the examination schools, and it's all absolutely terrifying.
But you acquitted yourself well in other matters. You apparently became very good at running uphill.
Well, I used to sing in two choirs, yes. I was in the choir at Christchurch Cathedral, which is the chapel of Christchurch College, or the, and a new college, and the two places didn't coincide, so I used to run from one to the other. You're quite right. I was jolly fit in those days.
And then you graduated, as we heard, and briefly, but very briefly, you were a schoolmaster.
Well, I did, because you have to keep body and soul together. So I was at a prep school.
What did you teach, history?
No, I taught geography, history, games, anything they wanted. I mean, you know, they were desperate.
And you were desperate and you hated it, is that right?
Well, I didn't. It was amusing. And some of the boys that I taught come up to me now and say, you were absolutely hopeless as a teacher. But my teaching career is remembered in certain places.
But then you met Benjamin Britten, so all was well.
Well, it sounds as if, yes, it all happened after that, yes.
Let's have the next piece. Oh, it isn't music.
No, I love the spoken voice. When I was thinking about my Desert Island Discs, I thought it would be a terrible shame to be marooned on an island and never hear English spoken. I mean, you could listen to the wind and the birds and heaven, but you'd long to hear a spoken voice, wouldn't you? I would miss it terribly, I must say. Mm. And I'm a great lover of Alan Bennett. I love his powers of observation, his wonderful, wonderful writing. And I was very torn which of these talking heads to have, but I love Stephanie Coles. I've always been an admirer of hers. I love her voice. I love the inflection she put into her voice. And this particular extract is a very touching one.
It's a funny time, 3 o'clock. Too late for lunch, but a bit early for tea. Besides, there were one or two brave souls who trekked all the way from Wolverhampton. Couldn't risk giving them tea or we'd have had a mutiny on our hands. And I think people like to be offered something, even if they don't actually eat it. One's first instinct was to make a beeline for the freezer and rout out the inevitable quiche, but I thought, Muriel, old girl, that's the coward's way out.
Stephanie Coles reading part of Alan Bennett's Soldiering On. And you better tell us the clowns. What's she talking about?
Well, she's actually leading up to the party, the wake back at her house after her husband's funeral. Mm. And all these people who've turned up she never knew at all. And it's a very, very touching story.
It's terrific, no? Benjamin Britten, we were saying earlier on that he'd written Oberon specially for Alfred Deller,
part
of Oberon in A Midsummer Night's Dream. Did he write anything for you?
Yes, he wrote me a small role in his opera Death in Venice, his last opera, and he also wrote a setting of a T.S. Eliot poem, The Journey of the Magi, for me with Peter Peers and John Shelley Quirk, the three of us.
Terribly flattering.
Wasn't it? Yes, yeah. I was absolutely thrilled. It was a lovely gesture. I remember when he wrote to me about it, and I wrote back and said how pleased I was, and he wrote a postcard ending with the words, Hurrah!
What was he like to meet?
Well, he was like a prep schoolmaster a bit. He was very shy, very correct. You could never cross a certain line with him. He was one of these people that always kept a distance between you and him. A touch, perhaps, of royalty about him. But you knew that if he approved of you, that you know, it was a very great honour.
So he increased the operatic repertoire of the countertenor by a large percentage, actually, if he wrote at least three major things.
Well, the role of Oberon, of course, was a major composition anyway in its own right, to set the Shakespeare opera to music so beautifully. And then to set this role, the central role for this rather unusual voice, was a great gamble. And people at the time told him he was mad, but he stuck to his guns. He didn't want a woman singing it. He didn't want a tenor to do it. He wanted a countertenor. He wanted my category of voice. And he wrote me a very sweet note after I'd done it, saying that I had vindicated his choice, which I thought was nice. Mm.
But the repertoire is generally really quite restricting, isn't it?
Well, it's enormous, up to the death of Bach and Handel, as it were, at the end of the 18th century. Then it fizzled out. Mm. There's nothing in the 19th century.
But Handel was presumably writing for castrati, who were the rage of the day.
Yes, this is true. Most castrati came from very poor families. I mean, they used to come to England. The story goes that they wouldn't get off the boat until they were paid in cash.
but wonderful parts were written for them, as you say, by
absolutely
Handel.
Stunning.
Xerxes, Tamerlano, we heard.
Yes, oh, wonderful. Julius Caesar, all these wonderful operas written for the...
And would Mozart have meant Cherubino to be sung by a castrati?
No. Cherubino was sung by a woman, I think, from the word go. But in Mozart's early operas, like Mitridate, there were castrato parts. Mm. But Mozart dropped the castrato in favour of women. Mm. Fashions moved on, and he got away from the Baroque world into the more Verismo world. So they're really, their heyday finished with the death of Handel, when Handel stopped writing.
But now you, I'm told, have officially given up opera, is that right?
The thing I've mainly given up is doing Midsummer Night's Dream. I've done it a lot now. I've done 10 productions and I've sung it a lot of times, and I felt it was time to give that a rest. So obviously, since my main role was Oberon, it sounds awful to say I've given it up, because it means I've rejected it, but it doesn't mean I don't like it, but I just think it's time that I moved on to other things.
But it's such a narrow repertoire anyway, as we were saying, for the countertenor to cut up opera out of it.
Well, yes, but basically I got tired of doing silly productions with silly producers. Not in this country anyway, but I mean, I think the opera scene in this country is wonderful. I love it. But, no, I made a very conscious decision to give up the stage.
Next piece of music.
Ah, now this is conducted by one of my great heroes, Bernard Haitink, with whom I did the aforementioned Midsummer Night's Dream at Glyndebourne. We did a wonderful production with Peter Horn, and Bernard conducted it absolutely wonderfully. And I've always adored Brahms' music. I've always said he's a desert island composer of mine. I've used that as a loose expression, and I love Brahms' symphonies. And to hear the Concertgebouw conducted by Bernard, to me, is perfection.
The opening of Brahms' Symphony No. 2, played by the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam, conducted by Bernard Haitink. Your career, James Bowman, has been linked with a revival of Baroque music, Monteverdi, Purcell, Bach, Handel, Couperin, which in turn, as we've been saying, has meant more prominence for the countertenor, which is why there are more around. How important a part, how much credit do you claim, really, for the revival of Baroque music?
I don't claim a credit for the revival, but I claim, shall we say, to have played a large part in pushing it all along in a sort of active way. When I first started, this revival of old instruments really didn't exist at all. They were totally unknown in this country, and not very much on the continent either. It was all performed in my early days by the English Chamber Orchestra, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, and the specialist chamber orchestras. But then, with the arrival of people like Christopher Hogwood, all that began to change, and then the record companies started to take an interest. I think the whole revival, really, couldn't have happened without the interest of the specialist record labels.
And more sophisticated recording techniques.
Yes, indeed, very much so. I mean, with CDs and the rest of it.
But what's created the appetite? Obviously, the recording techniques meant it was possible. What's created the appetite, do you think? Do you think it's because there are only a finite number of classical composers? You know, if you're going to go on and on listening to them, you want to hear them played in different
ways. Well, I think people were so excited when they first heard works like this in Matthew Passion, the Bach cantatas, bits of Handel, I mean, French Baroque music. When they first heard it performed on old instruments, it was an absolute revelation. And people really wanted to go on hearing more and more.
It's completely different noise.
Oh, totally, yes. I mean, it's the way the instruments are strung, the bows are different, the style of playing is lighter and everything. I mean, if you play Otto Klemperer's and Matthew Passion compared with John Elliott Gardner's, they sound like two totally different pieces.
And you apparently prefer working with those musicians.
They're incredibly sympathetic, wonderful people to work with. Some of my best friends are Baroque instrumentalists. I love them dearly. And there's much more of a feeling of camaraderie in the Baroque world than you get being backed by an enormous symphony orchestra.
Record number 6.
Now, Mozart's another great love of mine. My stepfather's a Mozart fanatic, and at home I always remember Mozart being played all the time. I've always loved his music. Once again, it's instrumental. You probably think it's a bit odd that I'm constantly choosing instrumental music, but I prefer to sing than listen to singing often, and I love instrumental playing. I find a great joy in hearing a violin concerto, or as in this case, a violin viola together, and this particular piece I've always been very fond of. Thank you.
Part of Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante K364, played by the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Neville Mariner. You had a vocal crisis in your mid-30s, James. What happened?
I did, yes. It was a very traumatic time, and I've never concealed it. I think it's good to, you know, if you hush it up, people begin to wonder what happened. No, I had a very dear colleague, David Munro, who was a wonderful musician who committed suicide in 1976. And largely it was a result of overwork, the usual old thing. You forget about your technique. If you're working very hard, if you're on the crest of the wave, you tend to not worry about the basics. You think you'll get by, and of course you don't. But I had a very bad schedule. I had to do a big recital in Vienna, and then I had to fly very early the next morning to Cologne to do, for some reason, a radio recording at before lunch, which is madness if you've done a big recital. Flying's the worst thing in the world for a voice anyway. Yeah. And I was run down and I had a throat virus and I sang on and my voice said, right, thank you very much, and packed up on me, literally in the studio.
What disappeared?
I couldn't control it. Mm. And I knew something was pretty badly wrong.
And how long did it go away for?
I lost my self-confidence and I really couldn't sing decently for about another 4 years.
Good heavens.
Yes, it was pretty traumatic. And then suddenly, in true British fashion, I said to myself, pull yourself together. And it came back again, luckily.
So it was connected to emotional stress.
Of course it was. I mean, a lot of it was psychosomatic.
Yeah.
I mean, but you've got to be very careful what you do. And a lot of people have never forgotten. I mean, critics still say, how nice to hear James Bowen back on form again.
And was it different when it came back on form?
Yes, it was slightly. It had a rather youthful quality before then, and should we say it became more mature.
But quite a shock.
It was horrible. Mm. It was very, very dispiriting time. To lose your self-confidence when you've always been rather full of confidence is a very, very unpleasant thing.
And how long does a voice last? Now you know to look after it.
Well, I used to say in my youth, oh, I won't go on singing beyond 50. But it's very difficult to say. I mean, if I say now, it's then carved in tablets of stone. If you say, right, retire at whatever age you say, I think you just go on. But if your closest and nearest and dearest tell you it's going, then's the time to give up. And I've got a lot of good friends who I know will say to me, look, I think it's about time you gave up.
And is that depressing to anticipate that moment when you no longer have this very precious thing about which your whole life has been?
I think it's a terrible moment, but you've got to have the strength of character to be able to do it. I think there's nothing worse than hearing an artist who's passed it.
Record number 7.
Now, this is a very odd choice. This is Charles Villiers Stanford, who was an Irish composer, largely neglected and forgotten nowadays, but in the 19th century he was Mr. Big. I mean, he ran music in London. Him and Hubert Parry were the two big names. And my antecedents are Irish. My mother is Irish, and my grandmother was the daughter of an Irish archbishop, of which I'm very proud, Archbishop of Dublin, and before that, Archbishop of Armagh. So my family is Irish Protestant, pre-partition Irish Protestant. And this symphony I love because it reminds me of going on holiday in Ireland when I was a young child. We used to go to Donegal every year for our holidays. And my grandmother was very staunchly Irish. She would never sit in a room with the curtains open because she was afraid she might have been shot at by the IRA. I mean, it was the Troubles impinged upon her life. And she was wonderful. She used to do the washing up in her hat just to prove that she shouldn't really be doing it. Because she was used to being looked after. But she was a real Irish lady. And she loved the music of Charles Villiers Stanford.
Opening of Charles Villiers Stanford's Irish Symphony No. 3, played by the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Vernon Handley. I'm told, James, that you have a working model complete with lights of the old Vic in your living room. Does this show a love of theatre or architecture or simply that you're good at making things?
All three, actually. I love models. If you'd asked me what my hobbies were, I mean, I love making things with my hand. I love a tube of glue, a cut-out model and a pair of scissors. That's my idea of relaxation. I don't knit. I don't do tapestry, but I love making things with my hands. And I've always loved theatres. And this wonderful man who makes toy theatres, it's actually rather large. It looks like a big doll's house. It sits in my living room.
And so you didn't make it?
No, it was made for me. I commissioned it.
I see.
Yes, no, I didn't actually make it, but I made all the scenery and all the rest of it. And it's got proper lighting and everything.
So you've hung the curtains nicely.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So what it all adds up to is give you a bit of old driftwood and you'll be as happy as a sandboy on the side.
Well, I'd have to have some Yoo-hoo glue. It's very essential, that.
But what about emotionally? Could you stick it all alone for heaven knows how long?
No, I think I'd be pretty hopeless, actually. Because I like human company. If you're in the music business, half your time is spent gossiping with other people. I think I've missed my friends terribly, yes.
And would you sing to yourself or probably more than
actually.
You would play your records or vice versa?
I wouldn't sing a lot, no. I think my voice would probably go into recession totally. I'd be quite good at building a house. I'd get on and make myself a habitation. I'd enjoy that. But once the novelty had worn off, then I think total depression would set in.
Last record.
Oh, yes, very appropriate for sitting on the beach at night looking at the sunset with Richard Strauss's Four Last Songs. I love Richard Strauss's music. I like the violence of Salome and the eroticism of Elektra and all these things. They're wonderful operas. As a Baroque singer, I would never, ever perform it. It's totally outside my brief as a singer, and that's why it's a sort of forbidden fruit. I love the lusciousness of it. And this particular recording by Jesse Norman's, for me, the ultimate in forbidden fruit.
Richard Strauss's Beim Schlafen Gehen, one of his four last songs, sung by Jesse Norman with the Gewandhaus Orchestra of Leipzig, conducted by Kurt Mazur. So, James Bowman, which is the most necessary of those eight records to you on your island?
Gosh, I think it's probably the Brahms. As I've said before, I've always felt of Brahms as a desert island-type composer.
What about your book?
I'm not the world's greatest reader. I read spasmodically. I eventually decided I'd probably like to take Rebecca. Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca.
It's a good yarn.
Well, it's a good yarn. I was thinking today that the heroine's such a drip, she wants a good slap. I mean, if I'd have been the heroine, I'd have given Mrs. Danvers what for pretty quickly, told her to get the hell out. But it's such a marvellous story, and it's so beautifully written.
Mm. How many times have you read it?
Oh, I don't know. I think at least twice.
What about your luxury?
Oh, no, yes, I'm very specific about this. Since I've come from a world where one has taken part in glamorous productions, one has sung in glamorous places, wonderful venues, to say nothing of the glamorous people you meet, I'd have to take something fairly glamorous, so I thought I'd take a Fabergé egg.
Wonderful. Just sort of sit it in the sand.
Oh, yeah, no, I'd make a special little shrine for it as a memory of the exotic Baroque world which I've inhabited from time to time.
James Bowman, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.